our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
A warning to our audience. We begin today's show with a story that contains graphic footage. Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank have shot and killed Shireen Abu Akleh, a veteran Palestinian-American journalist working for Al Jazeera, as she covered an Israeli army raid on the Jenin refugee camp early this morning. This according to the Palestinian Health Ministry and Al Jazeera. Video released by Al Jazeera shows the moments after Shireen Abu Akleh was shot in the face. A spokesperson for Israel's army told a military radio station that Abu Akleh was likely killed by Palestinian snipers, though he offered no evidence. Al Jazeera's Jerusalem bureau chief said Shireen Abu Akleh was targeted by direct shot from an Israeli sniper. A second Palestinian journalist, Al-Quds reporter Ali Al-Samoudi, was hospitalized in stable condition after he was shot in the back. Speaking from a hospital in Jenin, Al-Samoudi said he was among four journalists pinned down by Israeli snipers.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniforms, in addition to the helmets with the word press written on them in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious.
In a statement, Al Jazeera said it holds the Israeli government and its military responsible for the killing, condemning it as a, quote, heinous crime, which intends to only prevent the media from conducting their duty, unquote. The U.S. ambassador to Israel called for an investigation, tweeting he was, quote, very sad to learn of the death of American and Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, unquote. For more, we're joined by a dear friend and colleague of Shireen Abu Akleh. Dalia Hatouka is a Palestinian-American multimedia journalist who's extensively covered Palestine and Israel. She's joining us from Amman, Jordan. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dalia. Our deepest condolences on the death of Shireen. Can you tell us who she was and what you understand happened?
Thank you, Amy. So Shireen and I met many years ago in D.C. when we both worked for Al Jazeera. She was stationed at the Ramallah Bureau, but she was seconded to the D.C. Bureau for a bit. So we instantly became friends. Shireen was a Palestinian Christian from Jerusalem. She was very brave. She was a kind reporter. She had an infectious laugh. She gave voice to the struggles of Palestinians over a career spanning nearly three decades. During the height of the Intifada, she became a mainstay in every Palestinian home, to the extent that I recall Israeli soldiers going around Ramallah and mimicking her, shouting from their bullhorn her famous closing lines, Shireen Abu Akleh, Al Jazeera, Ramallah. My understanding is that she was on assignment in Jenin, like you mentioned. I just watched an extended video of the incident wherein Shireen was wearing a vest that was clearly marked press, and she was wearing a helmet. I saw that the shot came through the back of her neck and out of her face, and she didn't stand a chance. She didn't have time to take cover, and I believe that only an experienced shooter could have made a shot like that. My understanding is that the Israelis said that they are doing an investigation. I personally have no faith in any probe that's done by the Israelis. Many people have died and no one has been held accountable for their death. And perhaps this will be a bit different because Shireen is an American citizen. But that leads us to the question, why is being an American way more worthy of a probe than any other Palestinian, really?
And Dalia, most of the world has been transfixed on what has been happening in Ukraine for the last several months, the Russian invasion there. But could you talk about the what's been happening in the occupied territories and the increased violence that has been occurring on the side of both of the Israelis in those territories?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that there's been an increase in violence because violence is taking place every single day. There are home demolitions, demolitions of Palestinian homes every day. Palestinians are being expelled from their homes every day. Settlements are being built. So violence is kind of ongoing. The only reason you hear about extended violence is when Israelis are being killed. Neither Palestinians nor Israelis should be killed. I think there needs to be an end to that, and the only way to end that is by ending Israel's military rule of the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. But I want to circle back to Shireen for a second, because her killing is not an isolated incident. This has been happening for a long time, Israeli attacks against media workers, especially Palestinians, and the relative impunity under which they operate. And I believe that Human Rights Watch, Israel's premier human rights organization, B'Tselem, have all reached the same diagnosis, which is the reality that there is no accountability for these sorts of abuses when it comes to actions by the Israeli authorities. And, I mean, we recall, for example, the killings of two journalists by Israeli snipers who were covering the Great March of Return in 2018, and another two men who were maimed by Israeli sniper fire in 2019 and 2015, respectively. And the last thing I will mention is the targeting and the bombing of buildings housing media in the Gaza Strip, including the Israeli air raid that destroyed the Al Shalaa building, which housed Al Jazeera and the AP offices in May 2021. So these are not isolated incidents. And just the fact that there may be a probe is important. But at the end of the day, I don't think me or any other Palestinian really has any hope that this probe will lead to justice being served for Shireen or any of the other journalists being killed.
Just this latest, the spokesperson for Palestinian Authority, Ibrahim Milim, said his government rejects any role for Israel in investigation into Shireen's killing. He said, let me ask, when does the criminal have the right to take part in the investigation against his victim? International Federation of Journalists have submitted, are going to submit Abu Akleh's case to the ICC. And Anthony Bellinger, the secretary of the International Federation of Journalists, said Abu Akleh's killing is a deliberate, systematic targeting of a journalist. Final question to you, Dalia. This is attributed to Reuters, that there's an investigation that's going to be conducted, and Al Jazeera is saying that Israeli police have raided Shireen's home in Jerusalem, in occupied East Jerusalem, and have confiscated Palestinian flags and prevented the playing of nationalistic songs. Videos seen by Al Jazeera show friends and family shouting at Israeli police to leave the house. A journalist at the scene said the mourners managed to push the forces outside the house but remain stationed in the area. I understand, Dalia, the funeral is tomorrow in Jerusalem. Is that right?
Correct. I saw that video, and I saw that Israeli police raided the area around Shireen's home where people had gathered. People were gathering everywhere in Ramallah and in East Jerusalem. She worked in Ramallah, and her home was in East Jerusalem. They confiscated flags, like you mentioned. They prevented the playing of nationalistic songs. And my understanding is that tomorrow there will be a military what do you call it, like a military funeral. Thank you, a military funeral from the presidential from the presidential compound in Ramallah, and then she will be buried in East Jerusalem where she was born. And my understanding is that today there will be some vigils and other gatherings by friends and loved ones in Ramallah.
Well, Dalia, we thank you for being with us tomorrow. And Democracy Now! Will bring you more on the story. Dalia Hatukah, Palestinian-American multimedia journalist who's extensively covered Palestine and Israel, a friend of Shireen Abu Akleh.
Is Palestine news director for Mondelweiss. It's a news website focusing on Palestinian issues. She's joining us from Bethlehem. Thank you very much indeed for being with us. I'd like to ask you about the kind of conditions that you believe that journalists work under when they're covering this story.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I mean, I'd first like to express what a sad and tragic day this is for Palestinian journalists and, you know, Palestinians everywhere. As many of your guests have mentioned, and some of the Al Jazeera correspondents have mentioned, working on the ground in Palestine is often a very volatile situation. In my experience, in the years that I've reported here, journalists who are clearly marked as press often come under direct attack from Israeli forces. When we're covering protests, that can mean that journalists are either tear gassed, they're targeted with rubber bullets or with live ammunition, as was the case for Shireen and her team today. So it is not uncommon, in fact, it's very common for journalists to come under Israeli fire when they're covering events in the West Bank.
I understand that we can bring you live pictures at the moment from Shireen of Shireen's body being carried through the streets of the town where the shooting is said to have taken place. Shireen is a town in the northern West Bank. Yumna, we heard earlier on from Stephanie Decker, our correspondent, quoting the Israeli foreign minister, saying the death of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was Saad, and he'd offered to investigate jointly with the Palestinian Authority. How much confidence do you have in that investigation?
I would say little to no confidence. You know, time and time again, it has been shown that, you know, Israeli forces kill Palestinians, including Palestinian journalists, without cause in the occupied territory. And it's very extremely rare that Israeli soldiers, captains, or military officials are ever held accountable for their actions. You know, after sort of high-profile killings like this, or, for example, the killing of children that often get more significant media attention, it's not uncommon for Israeli officials to say that they will investigate, to express the quote-unquote sadness, and say that they will investigate these killings. But time and time again, almost without fail, these investigations lead nowhere, you know? And it's ironic, as Stephanie was reading out the Israeli foreign ministry's statement, you know, it's ironic that the foreign minister says that journalists must be protected when you're talking about journalism in Palestine. Israel is the biggest perpetrator of crimes against journalists in the West Bank. And so, you know, since 1967, 86 Palestinian journalists have been killed. Those numbers are from the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate. And since 2000, it's estimated that around 50 Palestinians have been killed. I talked to a representative from the Journalist Syndicate this morning. He said that just in the past 2 years, 6 Palestinian journalists were killed in the West Bank and Gaza. Hundreds have been injured, I mean, over the years. And according to Beit Salem, which is Israel's leading human rights organization, the use of lethal force by Israeli forces in the West Bank is a crucial element in Israel's ability to maintain its control over millions of Palestinians. And unfortunately, journalists are often the target, as they are the ones who are covering Israel's crimes and attacks in the occupied territory.
Yumna, stay with me for a moment. There have been a couple of statements that have been put out. Al Jazeera Media Network has put out a statement offering its condolences. It says, in a blatant murder violating international laws and norms, the Israeli occupation forces assassinated in cold blood Al Jazeera's correspondent. Al Jazeera Media Network condemns this heinous crime, which intends to only prevent the media from conducting their duty. Al Jazeera holds the Israeli government and the occupation forces responsible for the killing of our late colleague Shireen. It also calls on the international community to condemn and hold the Israeli occupation forces accountable. An official in Qatar's foreign ministry has also put out a tweet saying the Israeli occupation killed Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh by shooting her in the face while wearing the press vest and a helmet. She was covering their attack in Jenin refugee camp. The state sponsored Israeli terrorism must stop, and unconditional support to Israel must end. Yumna, let me ask you about the international pressure that we've talked about earlier on in the program. There have been suggestions that the only way that there is going to be any sort of solution, any sort of resolution to this particular incident in terms of an investigation would come from foreign governments. Again, how confident could you be that that kind of pressure could be brought to bear?
Unfortunately, again, I would have to say there's little to no confidence in foreign governments and third-party states at this point when it comes to putting pressure on Israel for its crimes. As one of your guests mentioned earlier, there needs to be a political will. But unfortunately, when it comes to Israel, there is no political will in terms of holding Israel accountable for its crimes and its attacks on the journalists and press. You know, time and time again, when Palestinian journalists are killed, when children are killed, when unarmed women are killed, when anyone is killed in the West Bank by Israeli forces, you know, oftentimes you'll see these sort of statements from U.S. or European officials. But unfortunately, they're often just sort of empty statements followed up by, you know, lack of action. It's one thing to say, oh, you know, we condemn this killing and we, you know, assert that Palestinian journalists or the rights of journalists should be protected. But if the U.S. were to come out with that sort of statement, but then immediately after continue funding Israel and continue funding Israel's military as it has been for years, sort of without any real consequences, then I don't believe that the situation will change or any accountability or justice will be seen for Shireen or the dozens of other Palestinian journalists who have been killed by Israel.
Yes, this isn't, as you say, the first time that this kind of thing has happened. How Do you notice a change in the attitude in journalists after an incident like this? Do you find that people reconsider whether they should be covering conflicts like this?
As I believe it was Stephanie who mentioned earlier, you know, this is absolutely devastating. You know, not only this is devastating for Shireen's colleagues, for her family, for her friends. My heart goes out to them. This has really shaken, I think, any Palestinian journalist, any journalist that's working here on the ground and across the world. That being said, I do not think that incidents like these shake the resolve of Palestinian journalists, because as you mentioned and as I've said, this is not the first time that this has happened. You know, Palestinian journalists continuously are under attack by Israeli forces in their work. This is not the first time a journalist has been killed or severely injured. And Palestinian journalists are, you know, frankly, never deterred and are determined to continue their work reporting on Israel's actions and crimes in the West Bank. Because if they're not here to do it, then who will be? And frankly, that is part of the reason, as some of your guests, I believe, have pointed out, why Palestinian journalists are often targeted. It's a method of deterrence that is employed by Israel, by the Israeli government and Israeli forces. You know, these Palestinian journalists, Shireen and her team, were clearly marked as press. There's no way around it. So when journalists are targeted, there is a reason for that. It's to deter them from their work. But Palestinian journalists are strong. They have conviction. And despite all the attacks against them every single day, they continue to do their work. So I don't believe that, you know, Palestinian journalists will be deterred after this. But it is extremely tragic and devastating news for journalists and for those who knew Shireen.
Hello, and welcome to the CJPME Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. Today, we are joined by Noor Watad. Noor is a Palestinian-Canadian living in London, Ontario, and she is also the host of the brand new CJPME podcast, All Things Palestinian-Canadian, which launched just last week. We'll speak to Noor about her vision for ATPC and why it is important to provide a platform for discussions of Palestinian identity, history, and culture. We'll also hear about Noor's experiences growing up in Jerusalem on both sides of the Green Line and discuss why Palestinian culture cannot be separated from politics. My name is Thomas Woodley. I'm the president of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and the host for today. And joining me is Michael Buechert, CJPME's vice president and the podcast co-host. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Tom.
And we are super thrilled today to have with us our colleague and friend, Noor Watad. Noor joined the CJPME team a few months ago, and she has recently launched the All Things Palestinian-Canadian podcast, which is, of course, why we're talking about her as per our introduction. But just by way of introduction of Noor herself, she has recently completed her degree in Media Information Technology from the University of Western Ontario. But beyond that, she's also co-author of the book Villa Dolorosa, which is a book about Syrian refugee women and their experience coming to Canada. She's also been co-author of a number of children's books as well. She has a lot of fun. She's had a lot of fun in her university program in media and broadcast journalism. And she was also very involved in the Palestinian solidarity work in her campus with the Palestinian Cultural Club. And we'll have the opportunity to talk to her about that as well. So, Noor, welcome to the conversation.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Michael. How are you guys? I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, it's just a thrill for us to have you. Thank you, Noor. And we're, of course, thrilled to see the launch of All Things Palestinian-Canadian. And it's great to see that we've already had several hundred downloads in the first 24 hours of the announcement.
That makes me so excited, honestly. This project has been in under the works for quite a while. So it's really exciting for me to actually launch it and have people listening to it.
Yeah, well, thanks for all your hard work. It has been in the works, but it takes quite a bit of effort to launch a podcast, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So thank you very much for your perseverance and your hard work in lining up interviewees and setting things up and preparing questions and editing interviews and the whole works. Well done. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, maybe we should start with the podcast since we're already into it a little bit. I know that the podcast itself is to some degree a melding of some of the ideas that we had here in CJPME, as well as some of your own personal ideas and vision. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your vision for All Things Palestinian Canadian?
Yes, so the ATPC, All Things Palestinian Canadian podcast, in it, we dive into the realm of what it means to be Palestinian living in Canada, where we explore aspects of history, politics, arts, culture, people, lifestyle, like when it comes to Palestine in Canada. And we're going to explore topics such as languages, beliefs, religions in Palestine. And we're going to dive into maybe, like, hopefully biographies of famous Palestinians, millennials in Palestine, people living in the West Bank, people living in Gaza, Palestinian values and traditions. So it really explores all aspects of Palestinian culture, and we relate it back to us living here in Canada.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, we've given a bit of thought to this, and you know, the types of, you went through it, you gave a great overview of some of the topics that that you're hoping to cover and all that. And we are hoping to cover a lot of ground, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead, sorry.
There's so much to Palestine to cover.
Yeah.
So really want to hit like every spot. And we want to shed light not only on the politics, because a lot of people speak about the politics in Palestine, but we want to shed light on the different aspects of the Palestinian culture as well.
That's right, because I think among a number of Palestinians and Palestinian Canadians, there's a slight sort of concern that it's easy for Palestinians to lose touch with their heritage and with their culture here in Canada, isn't there? I mean, how have you seen that, and how have you seen that that concern expressed?
You know what? Ever since I came to Canada, I honestly realized home is where the heart is. So my background as a Palestinian became even stronger when I moved to Canada, and my passion for Palestine only grew. But because I came straight from Palestine, I lived in Palestine, I knew what it was like to live there, and I dearly missed it, and I was really nostalgic for such a long time. But people who never lived in Palestine, especially Palestinian refugees who came from the UAE, from Saudi Arabia, from different parts of the Gulf specifically, don't know what Palestine is like. So they've never actually felt that nostalgia towards the country that they're originally from, because they've never truly been there. They've never experienced what life is like there. So I completely understand that. And ever since I came here and realized and started meeting people, especially in my university career, I met a lot of Palestinians and Arab people through clubs and through the Palestinian Cultural Club, through the Arab Students Association, etc. I met a lot of Palestinians, and I realized that not a lot of them are patriotic towards Palestine. They speak that they're from Palestine. They know that they're from Palestine, but they don't know which city they're from. They don't know their parents' history. They don't know their grandparents' history. And it always confused me, and it always made me sad, just because I felt like Palestine deserves more than that. It deserves the youth to understand what Palestine is, its history, its politics. And I really was eager to change that. That's why we also built that Palestinian Cultural Club in order to bring back the Palestinian culture and revive it and bring that to the attention of the youth.
Yeah.
But after the events of what happened last year, I feel like there has been such a huge change when it comes to Palestine. Although a lot of refugees have never been to Palestine, I feel like their patriotism towards their country even grew more, just because of the protests happening all around Canada and Ontario specifically, which is where I'm at. And after the news going on about the attack on Gaza or the attack on Al-Aqsa, I feel like that created and fueled passion. So I feel like a lot of the Palestinians that I know are very passionate about Palestine now and speak more about it. And I even realized that this year, during my last year at Western, I realized that so many people are coming even more to our events, and so many people are even prouder to say that they're Palestinian because of what was going on. And yeah. I feel like it happened at a certain time where everybody was growing up and everybody was slowly becoming aware of their background and getting in touch with their roots. So yeah. I feel like that created a change in Palestinian youth, especially people my age.
Yeah. Well, Palestinian identity is a complex thing. Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that experience of sort of consciousness raising is also just generational. In the sense that every 4 years or so, there's this new military offensive on Gaza that gets all this attention. And at those moments, it's in the news again. People are exposed to what's happening. They see the violence in social media. So it's not just Palestinian Canadians either. It's Canadians, too, who a lot of people for the first time are coming into contact with these ideas and problems. And you often see a big burst of BDS activity happening on campus after this, like we are now. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting, actually, that it's that's a phenomenon also among Palestinian Canadians themselves, because it makes more sense, you know, for people who aren't Palestinian, who have no connection to the region. Why would they know anything about it? It's interesting that this is sort of a wider, maybe a societal problem that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, you know, some of our listeners may know that my wife is Palestinian. So my children are half Palestinian, and Palestinian identity is a very tricky thing, slippery thing, especially when you're in diaspora. You know, so our children, they're told that they're Palestinian or that they're half Palestinian, but what does that mean to them if they haven't been there? You know, and so I think, Nora, you mentioned Palestinians from the Gulf, Palestinians from different places. And so, you know, and I quite often children in this type of situation, there's other scenarios where children can sort of be told that they're one thing, but not entirely feel that necessarily all the time.
Yeah.
And it can be a very complex thing that, you know, sometimes it's almost like they don't feel like they belong everywhere, or, you know, or maybe they have two homes.
Yeah.
But it's a complex thing. And I think the burden that you're feeling, Nor, is certainly a healthy one. And certainly I think there are a lot of people that would want to plug into to better understand, you know, the history, the individual cities, the points of origin, the customs, the traditions, you know, the attachment to the land, all these different things, which I think are sort of central to sort of this holistic Palestinian identity, if indeed there is one. So that's great. And I think, you know, you did mention, Nor, your generation. I think Michael made a good point, is that there are sort of these junctures through the course of the years that bring people together and get people thinking about this. And I'd never actually thought of it in the way that Michael described it. But indeed, I'm sure it happens, you know, every few years there's something that happens to give people a greater desire to be more connected. And I've sometimes used the example of my three sons, who are now 23, 21, and 19. And last year when Israel was assaulting Gaza, they too were saying, well, Daddy, where can we find more information about what's happened in Palestine? So you know, what you've described fits in with that exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, and now you have already published 4 or 5 episodes of the All Things Palestinian Canadian podcast.
Yes.
So we had a number of guests. Why don't we talk a little bit about each of them? I know we had Sarah El-Nafar. Do you want to tell us a bit about her?
So Sarah's quite the personality, and it was an honor to get her on the podcast. She's a lifestyle influencer on social media, on Instagram and TikTok to be exact. And she's a Palestinian individual. She's a Palestinian content creator. And a lot of her content creator, especially when the attacks on Gaza and the attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque were happening in 2021, she released a lot of content creation, raising awareness about what's going on. And in the podcast, she talks a lot about her experience through that, whether it was through the content creating that she was doing and spreading awareness for Palestine, or she even talked about the live stream that she was watching when Gaza got attacked, in a live stream that she was on, and it got a lot of noise. Mm-hmm. And that was very interesting.
Yeah.
And she talked also about how the university also suppresses her as a content creator and tells her not to post a lot about Palestine, which was also very interesting to know that it happens in our own universities.
Well, and it happens to everyone. You know, it's not like she was this you know, she was a campus leader on Palestinian political issues. She was just a social media influencer. And yet even someone like that sort of, you know, can be suppressed in various ways. Yeah. I thought that was a fascinating interview. And she, as you say, she's an interesting character, very colorful, and just has opinions and experiences in a lot of different things. Just very precocious, I found, as a young Palestinian, and I think a real sort of inspiration for young Palestinians in Canada. Well, and I guess you also interviewed the El Asala Dabki troop. Why don't you tell us a little bit about them?
The El Asala Dabki group is actually an old Dabki group in Canada. They've been established since like 2007, 2008, and they were actually established in my own city, London, Ontario. And basically, they do Dabki, which is a folklore Palestinian dance, and they do weddings. They perform at festivals. They perform in variety of different places, like parties, etc. And a lot of what they do is now on social media. They got a lot of popularity in the last year. After COVID, they kind of moved to social media because they couldn't meet up and practice Dabki. They couldn't meet up and do weddings. So they moved to social media to kind of keep them entertained and kind of spread the word about them. Right. So,
well, and we called it the episode. I think we called it El Asala Dabki in the Digital Age. What were you trying to get out with that?
So basically, they started making TikToks and Instagram videos about Dabki, about Zafi, which is a Palestinian, like, basically, Zafi is basically like you're shouting folklore music in the Arabic language, in Palestinian dialect, which is really nice. And they gained a lot of popularity on TikTok. They have like around 500,000 followers on TikTok itself, and they have around 60,000 followers on Instagram, which is crazy. And they've reached millions of viewers.
Well, the other thing I was going to say, what I thought was so interesting is, in addition to their sort of having being pushed by the pandemic to sort of go virtual, in addition to doing it in person, but really, you know, having no other choice for a year or two. But also I find that they've sort of become a fusion type of act, haven't they?
So they combine like hip hop music with actual Arabic music, and they would do the tabla, which is the drums, and they'd match it to the English music, which is so cool. They managed to do that really, really nicely, and it gained popularity a lot. Like, a lot of people liked that, and that kind of grabbed the youth, the Palestinian youth, as well as the youth, and it kind of taught them about the Palestinian Dabki. They taught them about the Palestinian culture, which was really nice.
Right. Well, we don't want to say too much about the much about the podcast, because we want people to listen.
You got to tune in at the 18th.
That's it. That's it. And then we had Dr. Munir El Qasem, who's a very important individual, also in the London, Ontario area.
So he's a Muslim imam, which means that he's a Muslim preacher in local mosques.
Right.
And he's also a nationwide public speaker. Mm-hmm. And he's a doctor. He's a dentist.
And a Palestinian, of course.
And a Palestinian, of course, which is why we got him. So Dr. Munir El Qasem is a really interesting person. He came to the podcast to talk about Ramadan. So we basically invited him at the beginning of Ramadan to shed light on how Palestinians celebrate Ramadan in Canada and how Palestinians celebrate Ramadan back home. And he's actually a Palestinian refugee. So he also talked about how Palestinian refugees celebrated Ramadan elsewhere, specifically Lebanon. But he shed a lot of light on that, which was really cool.
He did. And he has... he's getting on in age, but he has had a really interesting historical perspective on the Palestinian Canadian immigrant community. And so people that listen to podcasts can get a perspective on that. And he himself also has faced exclusion, and he also has been suppressed or repressed as a Palestinian. So listeners to the podcast will get
definitely
to hear a bit
worth
about
a
that.
Yeah.
And then the fourth guest that you've had, that part of the initial launch was Grace Bachun, who's a Montreal, was a Montreal area activist, still is a Montreal area Palestinian Canadian activist. What you want to say a word or two about her and that interview?
Well, Grace Bachun is quite the person to me. I really enjoyed my time meeting her. She's actually the co-founder of CJPME, which is the Canadian Justice for Peace in the Middle East, which is the CJP Me debrief, of course, especially by CJP Me. Anyways, I'm rambling on. Grace Bachoon, she's a human rights activist, and she was talking about human rights organizing when it comes to Palestine in Canada. So she shared quite a lot about that. Definitely worth a listen. It's one of my favorite episodes that I've done.
It was interesting, and she sort of also gave a bit of a historical perspective, a past 20 years perspective on advocacy for Palestinians in Canada. So fascinating. And she's always fun to listen to.
Yes.
Well, she's not the only person that's fun to listen to on your podcast. There's also Noor Wattad, who's an interesting person to listen to on the podcast. And you have quite the colorful background yourself. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your upbringing. I guess you grew up in Palestine. You were, I guess, you initially as a child, you first were living in East Jerusalem, and then your family moved you to West Jerusalem, the French Hill neighborhood of West Jerusalem. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your upbringing and your experiences sort of there in Jerusalem?
Yes. Okay. So, where do I start? Okay. So I was born in Jerusalem. I derive from East Jerusalem, but my parents actually, my mom is from Nazareth, which is in Nasira. Yeah, right. Northern of Palestine. And my dad's from Jat, a small village in northern Palestine as well. It's about 1 hour away from Nazareth itself. But my parents went to university in Jerusalem and they met there, and then we just remained there as a family. Okay. So that's how they kind of met, yeah. And so I grew up in East Jerusalem, and honestly, it was quite the upbringing because my mom comes from a Christian family and my dad comes from a Muslim family, but my mom converted to Islam, but obviously my mom's family is still Christian, very much Christian.
Right. Yeah.
So it was quite the upbringing. And then I also lived under, as an Arab Israeli citizen, because I was born within the 1948 territories. So I kind of got a little of the three religions, the three Abrahamic religions, while living in Palestine. So my mom comes from the Christian side, my dad comes from the Muslim side, and then the whole state is run under the Jewish religion.
Right.
So I grew up learning about the three religions, which was very interesting.
And I guess in the course, you went to a private American school. Language of instruction was English, but you were also taught both Arabic and Hebrew. So you did learn Hebrew growing up, I guess.
Yes, I also learned Hebrew growing up. We would have three Hebrew lessons a week. Ever since you hit grade three, you'd start having Hebrew lessons. But I also knew Hebrew prior to that because I went to a kindergarten and a preschool learning Hebrew. So I spoke Hebrew fluently as a child. But then I forgot some of it. But then, of course, as I grew up and reached grade three and needed to start learning Hebrew, I kind of got it all back. And now I know how to read and write Hebrew. Yeah. And I understand Hebrew really well. And it's kind of something that you have to know in order to function as a living citizen in Israel.
Yeah. Now, Michael looked up French Hill on the map, and he sort of found it was in proximity to a number of things. What do you see there, Michael?
Well, I mean, I was just I wasn't that familiar with that particular neighborhood, but you know, it was within the borders of sort of 1948 Palestine or Israel, and is not considered occupied territory. The area where you were is right. It's above the old city. It's sort of right across the valley, I think, from Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, very close to the apartheid wall, which cuts through there and is surrounded by Israeli illegal settlements.
Yes.
And I believe Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, I think, is pretty close to there. Mm-hmm. So it's right in the heart of things, and certainly not an area that, you know, you could say is sort of free from, you know, the violence and segregation of occupation, if that makes sense. It seems to me that you still would have witnessed a lot of aspects of occupation while living there.
I did. Actually, at one point in my life when I lived in Beit Hanina, which is East Jerusalem, where I actually grew up, I used to live right beside an apartheid wall. So when I looked outside my window, the apartheid wall was there. And behind the apartheid wall was the city of Ram, which is in the West Bank, and it would literally, we would go there every Sunday to buy Palestinian products like groceries, and it would take us about an hour to get there, but it's literally a 2-minute walk down the street.
Wow.
And every time there was like a grocery store, like a small Arabic Palestinian Palestinian owner who sold some groceries right down the street too, right beside the apartheid wall. And every time I'd go there, my mom would literally be like, go with your brother, because we're so scared that Israeli soldiers are all down the street with their jeeps that they drive. Yeah. And my mom would be terrified, but honestly, I didn't see a problem with it. I'm like, okay, there's an Israeli soldier. It's what I grew up to seeing. Yeah. I'd go to a restaurant, I'd go to the mall, I'd just see soldiers with big guns just walking around normal. And I'd be like, okay, this is normal to me. I didn't see anything wrong with it. I mean, I knew Palestine was an occupied country, but I was just so consumed by seeing them all the time around me.
Yeah.
That I just felt like the occupation was normal. So when I came to Canada, it was so hard for me. I was like, I was not seeing soldiers all around me. I wasn't seeing police officers everywhere, or, you know, is like soldiers everywhere holding ammunition guns, just walking down and up the street.
That is such a shocking thing for I myself, when I visited Israel, Palestine, I was shocked, of course, in the opposite way, which is, why are there all these people walking around with machine guns?
Mm-hmm.
You had the opposite. You grew up thinking that was normal.
Yeah.
So, totally different. And I guess you'd mentioned in the past that you really felt a second-class citizen when you and your family would go through the airport.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah. What would you guys experience?
So every time we travel, it would be horrible for us. I mean, just the fact that we appeared Arab, or like even on our passports where it says like my dad's name is Osama, my name is Noor. These are obviously not Jewish names. It would immediately appear like we're Palestinians, which means, and we have the Israeli passport, where we're considered essentially Arab Israelis or second class citizens to Israelis. We're not regarded as actual Israeli citizens. Of course, I'm saying that in quotation marks. We would be stopped. Our luggages would be checked over and over again. Everything from our luggages would be taken out. My brother would be just, all his clothing would just be off of him, and he'll just remain in his undergarments, just being checked. I would have to go through the security
scanner, the x-ray scanner,
and multiple times, just so they can make sure that I have nothing on me. And I was a little child. I was like 13. Whenever we'd go to Turkey, whenever we'd go to Europe, as like a family vacation, we're obviously happy and excited, but my parents are just like, don't say much in Arabic, because we don't want to grab their attention and go hours through security just because we look and appear Arabs.
And that's what people under occupation sort of have to try to do, don't they? They just sort of try to blend in and try to try to speak the language of the oppressor and look like the oppressor.
And you know what? That's an everyday thing for a lot of Palestinians, just because a lot of Palestinians work within the West Bank, or they'd have to go through the checkpoints all the time, almost every single day. So that's a daily thing for a lot of Palestinians. We would go to the West Bank once a week and we'd still be so scared. But the airport, it's really scary when you're going through it.
Yeah. Well, it's right. And it's sometimes, I know I've spoken to Palestinians in Israel who sort of say, well, we're better off than the Palestinians in the West Bank. And they may be, but they also say, well, we can't fool ourselves into thinking that we're anything like equals here in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe, I do have a good job and I have a little bit more stability than if I were living in the West Bank right now. Of course, the reason is less stable in the West Bank is because of the occupation. But in no way are you a fully an Israeli citizen with full rights, as long as you're a Palestinian living there. And of course, that's of course one of the focal points of much of the activism, is to make sure that Palestinian citizens of Israel enjoy full rights.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you did come to Canada about 10 years ago. You were about, I guess, 14 years old when you came to Canada. And so you've already mentioned how you were surprised that that there weren't soldiers walking around the shopping malls. What were there any other adjustments for you? Anything, any other cultural changes as you and your family made your life here in Canada?
You know what? The thing I was surprised about the most, especially as a teenager, I used to go always with my friends to the mall in Israel, in quotation marks, but we used to always go to the mall, and we would have, whenever we pull up in the car to go to the parking lot, they'd check our car from the inside, and they'd make us get out of it and look into it. And then when we're walking inside the mall, they also have to check our bags. They have to scan us. We have to go through the machine scanner. So it was just a hassle to go through that every single time. And I literally feel illegal just walking in there. I'm like, is there something wrong with me? Like, I'm not carrying anything bad. Or like, I'd have to take off my Palestinian necklace whenever I go through it, just because obviously I don't want to be interrogated by them or stopped or anything, because I've seen it happen. So when I came to Canada, especially as a Canadian, like as a young Palestinian who didn't know much about what's going on in Canada, didn't know anything about Canada really. I just knew it's in North America. I just knew they spoke English, but I had no idea exactly what Canada held for us. Mm-hmm. It was weird because I used to always go with my friends to the malls here, and every time I walk in, I just feel so grateful. I'm like, there's no occupation here. There's nothing of that sort. So that was very different. That was like a culture shock for us. I thought it was normal back then. Like, okay, they don't want to, they were just scared for the people in the mall. Like they're scared for their safety. But now, of course, like you'd think that if it was an Israel country by itself and there's no Palestinians or Arab citizens there, I don't think they'd hold a security like that.
That's right. You're always suspect as a visible minority, or as an identifiable minority. You were always a target. You were always racially profiled. There in Israel and coming to Canada. It's not to say there isn't racial profiling going on in Canada in certain circumstances, but certainly not to the same degree.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Now, then, of course, you did your degree at University of Western Ontario, and we talked about media information technology. So you've always had a keen interest in media, and that's why we hired you as a director of media and communications. Yeah. But I guess you also were involved in the Palestinian Cultural Club. Now, why did they call it the Palestinian Cultural Club and not something like the Palestinian Justice Club or something?
That's very interesting. Basically, there was a Palestinian club, but it was political, and it was shut down just because it was really vocal when it comes to the Palestinian.
The university shut it down because they didn't like what they were saying, even though what they were saying was the truth.
And then after a couple of years, we're like, you know what? There's a lot of Palestinian presence at the University of Western. Mm-hmm. And we need a Palestinian club, but how can we go about this without risking the without it shutting down?
Being
shut down, because we don't want to put it in jeopardy, of course. Right. And we want it to remain there for years and years. And we want to establish like a place at the university as Palestinians. We want Palestine to have a name at Western.
Right.
So we're like, okay, we're going to go about this by spreading the Palestinian culture. And for a couple of years, I was president and I was vice president for the remainder of the time, but we focus a lot on the Palestinian culture. And although in the back of our minds, we're always like, we're going to bring in the politics sooner or later. We always focus on the Palestinian culture, and we aim to spread the Palestinian culture, which is of course something that we should all do. Mm-hmm. But we always had that missing part, because it's not the Palestinian culture without the Palestinian politics, because a lot of what goes on depends on the Palestinian politics. Like, they all play a role. They all coincide together.
They do.
So this year we were like, we're going to be political. We don't care what goes on. We're going to be vocal about our role at Western. And we got in touch with the USC president, which is the student council.
Yeah.
And he's pro-Palestine. And he pushed us to do it. He pushed us to be vocal. And he's like, if anything happens, I'm going to back you up. I'm going to be there for you guys. And that's kind of the person that gave us the push to be more vocal, and that person that stood his ground when it came to the Palestinian cause and being vocal about Palestine at Western. So ever since, we've been vocal. We actually We're in contact with the EDI, which is Equity, Diversity,
and Inclusion.
Person at Western representative, and we tried to adopt the IRA.
That's great. He had a campaign around this new definition of anti-Semitism and so on. That's great. Well, I just got to point out, I think, just so our listeners, so it's interesting in the terms you come from Palestine, Israel, you make your life in London, Ontario, you enter university, and then again you meet these obstacles, or Palestinian students meet these obstacles, that basically the ability to talk about your culture and your heritage is sort of off limits. And, you know, often what people say about sort of culture and language is that as you learn a language, you learn a culture. And as you learn a culture, you sort of learn the politics and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it really is tied together. But sort of be told, well, you can talk about like food and you can talk about clothing, but you can't actually talk about what's mm-hmm. most on your heart, which is the oppression and humiliation of Palestinians under occupation.
And sadly, I just want to mention, although we were a Palestinian cultural club the first couple of years, we still received a lot of criticism from the Israeli clubs on campus. Mm-hmm. And we were targeted for it because we're a Palestinian cultural club and we weren't saying anything about political issues, but we were still targeted. So that kind of also pushed us to be more political, because we're like, we got to stand up for ourselves. We got to have a voice in these situations.
Yeah. What I thought when you were telling me that earlier, I feel like it's so interesting that you've had such a rich variety of experiences in terms of, having grown up in Israel, Palestine, having come to Canada, having faced this, other types of discrimination or exclusion for your views, for who you are here in Canada.
Yeah.
And it's I'm just excited to see all things Palestinian Canadian, capture a bit of who you are, capture a bit of what Palestinian is and what Palestinians are. Capture a bit the struggles of Palestinians in Canada and of course more broadly. So we're just excited.
I'm very excited about that. I mean, now I can talk about Palestine and of course Canada, but bring in Palestine a lot because it's my background without nobody stopping me or like being like, okay, she's talking about Palestine too much because it's my background. So I'm really excited about that.
It's fantastic. Yeah. So we invite people, those people that have enjoyed the CJP Me Debrief podcast, we invite you guys to hear more from Noor and hear more from her guests on all things Palestinian Canadian. It's a great podcast. Like CJP Me Debrief, Noor is planning on putting out about one episode a week. So, so if you want, subscribe to that podcast, and we'll put the links to that podcast in our show notes here for today. So, Noor, thank you very much for joining us, and all the best and best of luck with all things Palestinian Canadian.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed my time here.
If you're a listener and you've enjoyed our podcast today, please subscribe to our channel or on all the major audio podcast platforms. If you can, please leave a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people to find our program and learn about the issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about our podcast or our topics, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all our supporters who helped to make this podcast and all CJPME's other activities possible. Thanks also to Madeline Moffitt, our podcast engineering consultant. So that's it for now. Take care. We'll look forward to having all of you with us for our next podcast.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.